Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching the Romanoffs. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm chief critic Richard Lawson.
We are past the midway point on our exploration of the Amazon series, The Romanoffs. This week, we'll be discussing episode 5, Bright and High Circle, written and directed by Matthew Weiner. And at the end of the episode, we will have an interview with episode star Andrew Rannells. But first, before we get to any of that, Richard, I just want to like get your overall feelings on this already controversial episode.
Yeah, I mean, it's like kind of like, remember the N, the old promos for like Degrassi, like it goes there. Like in some sense, it's like Matt Weiner went there. like it's funny that we devoted so much of last week's episode, talking about the real world stuff involving, you know, accusations against him. Whereas then this episode, I feel like is much more directly grappling with that stuff, in a way that I think is kind of bad.
Well, what's interesting to me is that Amazon has been so enormously like helpful working with us on this podcast, and they sent me like so many of the episodes in advance so we could do a lot of prep, but they held this one back until this week, and I don't know, I can't tell you why, but I would suspect this is kind of why, is some of the stuff we're about to talk about here. So is your, you know, your overall take when we were watching it seemed to be more positive than I think the place you're in right now. Is that the case?
Well, it's funny. I was talking with New Yorker television critic Emily Nussbaum, who had tweeted something negative about the episode, and then I sort of like took it to DM, and I was saying that I like what it's about, the episode, or partly about. I don't like how it's about that, though, if that makes sense. Like, there is an aspect to this episode that we'll dig into that I think I've really never seen sort of so thoroughly explored on television. And yet it's all in service of a sort of sneaky exoneration of perhaps Matt Weiner himself.
So Emily tweeted out on Halloween, tweeted out, offensive and poorly timed yet incoherent but also boring. Bonus points for wasting Ron Livingston and Andrew Rannells. I guess I should do a little bit of premising for the episode. This episode, Bright and High Circle, is about a mother and a professor, Catherine Ford, played by Diane Lane. She is our Romanoff, our secret Romanoff in this episode. We met her in the previous episode. She's the sister-in-law of Amanda Peet's character from episode 4. We've got Ron Livingston as Alex Myers, her husband, who is like a web app developer. Andrew Rannells as their kid's piano teacher, David Patton, and then Cara Buono and Nicole Ari Parker as two other moms, who also employ David. And the episode is about some vague, unspecified accusations, rumors, about David surface when the police come to visit Catherine. And she spends the rest of the episode trying to figure out whether or not sort of such vague, unsubstantiated rumor / accusation, because we never really find out what exactly it is, means that she should cut this person out of her life, or whether, you know, it's not enough to cut him out. And she decides, you know, whatever, spoiler for the end of the episode, she decides to keep him with her kids, and not just like, not just keep him teaching her kids, but the episode ends with this very pointed, like, closing the door, like, not just keep with caution, mm-hmm. but keep with, like, you know, implicit trust, which, I mean, is actually like the hardest note for me to swallow in the whole episode, is that closing the door at the end. So
yeah, and kind of what it is saying about other things that are sort of meta-textually related to the episode, but not actually what the plot of the episode is.
Right.
You know, and I think that it's key to say that, like, when Diane Lane's character is approached by this detective saying, you know, there have been some complaints or whatever, nothing, no formal charges, you know, I guess most people would jump to this conclusion too, but she immediately assumes it's sexual, you know, some sort of sexual abuse, rather than something else, which it, you know, sort of proves to be. But, you know, and I think in that, that's Weiner getting into something that is interesting. But, you know, he sort of uses an assumption that a lot of people have, either consciously or subconsciously, about gay men and children, and uses it, I think, a little thoughtlessly to sort of be like, hey, like, you know, accusations, you know, they're, who knows really ever. It could just be a joke or whatever. And I think that that seems to be pretty pointedly related to his own life.
Absolutely. I mean, like, there's no sidestepping the parallels between the, you know, things we've discussed about Matthew Weiner before on this podcast and the subject matter of this episode. But I do want to mention, I want to get into, like, some specific kinds of reactions, because we have the different moms reacting in three different ways, basically. Before we get into that, I wanted to talk to you specifically about the fact that, like, David is a gay man, what that means for the various characters, the various assumptions that are made, and, like, how you reacted personally to that. And, like, so to quickly say that, like, the Ron Livingston character, Alex, has this reaction that, like, shocked me. From the beginning of the episode, this character of Alex, like, does not like David. There's a scene in the kitchen before any of like the police come to visit Catherine, where, like, you know, the dad of this family just blatantly does not like this guy. And I was like, is this homophobia? I don't know what this is. I, like, you don't know why he's being so chilly and rude to the Andrew Rannells character. And then when Catherine goes to talk to her husband about this, he basically goes, I knew it, right? I knew something. And then she's like, why didn't you say anything? He's like, oh, well, you know, that you don't want to, like, play into that stereotype of, like, gay men and kids. And, you know, here's where I will put my ignorance fully on display and say, like, I didn't know. Of course I should have known, but I didn't, like, know, really think about that being a thing.
Right.
And that makes me sound really stupid, and that's fine.
No.
But, like, of course it is. And of course I know that there, like, something that Andrew Rannells said when he talked to me is he talked about confusion between homosexuals and pedophiles, and how that's just been, like, an inextricably linked sort of association for so long. And it's just not something that, that I had, like, I guess I had the luxury of not having to think about that all the time. You, Richard, do not have that luxury. So, like, what is that, seeing that play out, mean to you?
Well, I think, yeah, I think that it's, there are a lot of reasons why gay men are so frequently, again, either consciously, subconsciously, actively, passively, associated with pedophilia, because, you know, for a long time and still, pedophilic men had easier access to boys than they did girls. And you see that in the church with, like, altar boys and stuff like that. And were sort of more trusted with male children than they were with girls. And so it became this thing. It was like, oh, you know, like, it's a gay thing. It's a homosexual thing. It's not. It's sort of viewed, I think, by a lot in the sort of psychological community as almost like another or sexual orientation. You know, I'm not an expert on that, but that is my sort of vague understanding of it. Anyway, the way that that has sort of pervaded into, I think, a cultural consciousness is that there is this kind of mild question, this wonder, this kind of little needling thing that's like, I think when gay men exist in spaces that are sort of directly in near children or sort of tangentially, that I think even the most progressive, people, sort of straight people, sort of fall prey to in a way. And it's a really shitty kind of pervasive, but also vague prejudice. And it certainly could be one that I, and projecting a little bit sometimes, you know, in being nervous of being around kids, because I'm nervous about what, like, their parents are going to, you know, like, even with sometimes with family members, you know, children, I make a note to, you know, keep a something of a distance. Not that I like actually really like kids that much anyway, but like, it's just it's a concern. It's, you know, and it's exhibited in ways both tacit and direct. And I think that the episode, albeit insensitively, talking about that topic from a place of some understanding, I think was felt really rare to me.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's not something that is at all ancient, because, like, you know, since the episode raised it and then you and I talked about it a little bit before we recorded this episode, I've been thinking about I remember the campaign in California around Prop 8, the failed attempt to legalize gay marriage, and that happened before it was legalized later, but the propaganda around it, and I will call it propaganda, was like, think of your children. And I even remember, you know, like this, I was in my early 20s when Prop 8 was on the ballot, but like, I just remember like, being so confused. I'm like, what does gay marriage have to do with your children? I don't understand. And now, like, obviously that makes sense. And like, the same thing is going on with like trans rights and bathrooms. The main thing that's raised is like, think of your children. That line makes like a grain more sense to me, that connection line, but it still doesn't make a ton of sense. And now I understand that it's leaning on this prejudice that I didn't even really realize was a thing. To be able to see that, to be able to see that represented, and just spoken, you know what I mean? Spoken by a character who's not, what is interesting about this episode, I think, is the, you know, the Ron Livingston character of Alex. It's a little muddled to me, sort of what exactly is going on here, but like, he's not a, like a bad guy necessarily, quote unquote, you know, he's not like a villain, just like dropping some like hardcore homophobia where you're like, oh, that's a bad dude. And I can like discount it. He's got this like liberal guilt around the knee jerk assumptions that he has. This episode was originally meant to be set in the Bay Area, but due to the fires that were here last year, they wound up filming in LA. And so it's weirdly set in LA, but you can kind of tell that it was supposed to be a Bay Area story because they keep talking about Google and San Francisco and all this sort of stuff like that. And the Bay Area, even more so than other parts of California, has this really interesting coexistence of like fiercely liberal ideals with like so much money, and with so much money usually comes conservative ideals. And so it's there's a lot of like virtue signaling and all sorts of stuff that goes on up here. Has been my experience. So like, it kind of makes sense to me that there are these rich people, rich parents, rich women who want to be seen as super progressive and, oh no, oh my God, our fabulous gay piano teacher, blah, blah, blah. But then can as easily as anyone else fall victim to certain prejudices, you know?
Yeah. And I think that I am glad that the episode doesn't do it with like, you know, sort of bonk you over the head. Like, there's not this sort of direct, like, gay men are pedophiles thing. It's subtler and thus so much more truthful in that, you know, I remember I was talking about something somewhat related to this, with a friend after Thanksgiving last year, talking about a relative's kid who, you know, may or may not be in the search and discovery phase, let's say. And I sort of was talking to him and I was like, oh, I used to like, you know, like doing that when I, you know, like theater or whatever, when I was in high school. And the way that my family member bristled, you know, my friend was like, you know, the thing about being gay is that like, that talking about it is always R-rated, you know, no matter what. And I think that for so many people, the minute that like the fact of your gayness is exists in their head, all of a sudden they don't like where it takes them. And so they kind of back away and they kind of jerk away, you know? And I think that the episode kind of illustrates that really well, especially in that, like, look how willing they are to sort of go there. They're like, you know, we really love him. He's so good with the kids, but like, yeah, you know, that's who they are. You know, they just fall into that assumption so quickly because it's always there. It's always very close. I'm not saying for everyone, but I'm saying that, like, even with, like, you know, friends, people I know well who are straight, some of them, if they ask me about how I'm doing or like what my love life is like, they really want one sentence and they don't want anything more involved than that. And I can see that it makes them uncomfortable. Of course, I might be projecting some, but like it's absolutely there. And so I think this episode's exploration of how gay people, particularly gay men, function in progressive, largely straight communities is well observed. That said, I don't like that it's well observed in function of something else.
That leads me into wanting to talk about this trio of reactions that the episode sets up, because you've got the Alex character, the dad character, but he's like somewhat preferable because he's always traveling, because, you know, he's an LA guy whose business is all in Silicon Valley, I guess. But you have these three moms, right? So you've got Diane Lane as Catherine, Cara Buono as Debbie, and Nicolari Parker as Cheryl. And you've got three reactions where you've got one woman who is like immediately, no, I don't believe this. How disgusting that anyone would insinuate anything about this person. I'm fully on their side. And then you have one woman who is immediately, get this guy out of my life. This guy is immediately a villain. I don't need to ask any other questions. This is it. And then in the middle, you have Diane Lane, who is genuinely in conflict almost the entire episode, without genuinely in doubt, right?
Yeah.
Wondering and conflicted the whole episode and just wanting to get a firmer sense of the truth before she makes any, draws any conclusions. And so she winds up asking each of her boys in turn if they, you know anything about this. One's in college, one's like a young teen, and one's much younger. You know, and asking these moms what they know and really trying to get more information from the police, who are, you know, legally bound to not talk to her. And so I find that exploration of the spectrum of the way in which we react to things, because we, as, you know, even leaving the Matthew Weiner out of it, which we cannot possibly do because this is a show that he has written and created. We've had so many other occasions, Richard, you and I and everyone else, to find out something about someone we thought we knew, what, you know, as much as we can know a celebrity, or if we know someone personally, mm-hmm. and how we've processed that reaction. For me, I think the Diane Lane path of like trying to get as much information as possible for drawing conclusions, feels like the sensible path. I think what we see a lot is the knee jerk writing off of someone. And we talked about this, obviously, with the whole like cancel culture conversation that we had, mm-hmm. The knee jerk writing off. I see less the like knee jerk defense, though you do see that. You see, like, you know, if like a comedian, say, gets called out for something, his comedian friends circle the wagon or something like that, you know.
Well, but that's the interesting thing. It's usually about, it's more about protecting your own, you know. Yeah. And I think that there's a difference between, you know, the moms and David, but, you know, and yet still there is this one sort of protective response.
Yeah, it's interesting to me. Like, I don't know. Do you think that is like too ham-fisted to make it just like three approaches and no, you know, one in a shade of gray and two extremes? Or do you think that that's well done to show these different dynamics?
I mean, I would say that this episode is curiously, you know, I think that Matt Weiner has some problems in the way he creates things, but I don't think that like being non-observant is one of them usually. And yet this episode feels, it's in the writing of these women, like, feels kind of stilted and like not, like it feels like they're all kind of archetypes and like, and avatars of a sort of idea. And so I think that it doesn't really work, even though I think you probably need all of those reactions in the story if you want to sort of look at this issue the way he wants to look at it. So I guess maybe there was a more subtle way to do it, but I'm not sure what that would be in, you know, an hour.
Yeah, I think I was interested in what else this episode reveals about the David character in terms of the different faces that he puts on for different people, and the way in which the Catherine character is surprised to find out that he like goes on family trips with some people, or that you know he has been lying about certain things. She gets most especially affronted when she finds out he was passing himself off as a Romanov when she's Romanov, which I think is like of all the things I like in the episode, this is kind of the thing maybe I like the most, is that she seems more upset almost by that than the other mysterious, alarming accusations that are in the water, because, like, you know, how dare you pass yourself off as a Romanov? I'm the Romanov here. Sort of being a weird priority for her. But what do you think of this idea, this exploration of, like, code switching that this episode has?
I mean, I think, again, that, like, I think that that's accurate. I think that the scene in the kitchen at Carabono's house, this, you know, sort of Rococo ornate thing that he kind of makes fun of. I think that's a little stereotypical, but I think it's absolutely true that, you know, people but I think queer people in particular, people of color existing in largely white spaces, like, you put on different hats, you sort of reveal X amount to some people, Y amount to others. I think making him a sort of pathological liar muddies that clarity a little bit. Obviously, like, it makes him more of a sort of outsized character. But I think the idea that, like, a person in his position would be altered depending on who he was interacting with makes total sense and, feels true.
The way in which he, like, insinuates himself into whatever situation he finds himself in reminds me a lot of The Talented Mr. Ripley, which has its own, like, positive and negative associations about gayness, a lot of negative associations with gayness. But in this episode, what I find interesting about that is, like, there are things that we know are, like, morally dubious about this guy. This guy's a liar. Like, this guy has done wrong things. And I think that that's interesting because it's not like the question then becomes of the episode, like, it isn't, is this guy a saint or is he a sinner? It's like, okay, this guy definitely has done wrong, but is it like wrong enough? Is it the right kind of wrong? Like, what is this, you know, what judgment are we passing here? And that, I guess, is where we bring it back to the Matthew Weiner metatextual aspect of it, where it's like Matthew Weiner, as we discussed in a previous episode, like, has admitted, like, yeah, I've said bad things to the people that work for me, and I probably shouldn't have said them. And he was like, but his argument is then, you know, but I didn't cross the line in this way. And
yeah, and he said that he was joking, which is a direct thing that happens in this episode, which is like, oh yeah, maybe he made a joke to me about like blowjobs or something.
Right.
And it's like, well, oh, but he was just kidding, you know, and then Ron Livingston kind of comes around on it. I think that something also involving, you know, because that's information that Diane Lane's character learns from her son, who her eldest son, who we see making out with a girl, maybe in his dorm room bed, maybe about to have sex with her, thus asserting his straightness. But then there's a little brother who, you know, is a tiny kid. And then there's this middle teenage brother who presents maybe a little effeminately, knows things about David's personal life, that he has a boyfriend, is very defensive of him. And maybe there is an implication in the episode that that kid is supposed to be gay, but they don't really go into that. I wish that they had. And I think that had the episode gone into that, I think it would have been more about what it's surfacely about. But again, Weiner was too distracted because he had to steer the story towards this exoneration of the rumored about, and the sometimes inappropriate. And, that's where the episode lost me, you know, in general, because I just am like, you can't take this really personal thing for a lot of people and use it that isn't your experience and use it in this way to kind of like talk to some, you know, some stuff about your own personal life outside of the world of the show. It feels really unfair.
So something that I raised to you when we were initially talking about this episode is I was like, okay, you know, this link between accusation and, you know, homosexuality, I guess, made me think of Kevin Spacey. And then you wanted to draw like a really hard line between what Kevin Spacey did, which is this sort of like, you know, I was drinking a lot and I was confused and I don't know what I did with that kid, but also, hey, I happen to be gay. And you're like, what does one have to do with the other? Like, and mm-hmm. how dare you actually muddy the water by associating those two concepts? Kevin Spacey was sort of the reaction to that. How is that distinct from what you feel like Matthew Weiner is doing in this episode?
Well, I think something I said to you over text is like, what frustrates me is that we know that Matt Weiner is a smart guy. And we know that he, you know, whether on this show or certainly in Mad Men, that he can be a great observer and teaser out of emotional truth and the way that people organize themselves with each other, either in a home or in an office and whatever kind of setting. And so he knows that, I believe that he knows that this thing about David or about gay men and this kind of presumption is wrong and is a widespread enough thing to be, you know, kind of conscious of, for, you know, a straight guy who doesn't need to be. And so if he knows it's that big of a thing to talk about it, but all really only actually be talking about himself and sort of, you know, his bad behavior that he's not really actually interrogating. He's just kind of saying, eh, like it's not a big deal. I just feel like that feels really, it feels a little exploitative, honestly. And, so it's why I feel so ambivalent about this episode, because on the one hand, I'm thrilled that that kind of really tricky stuff is being spoken about. And then, but also you realize toward the end of the episode, you're like, oh, this is all just kind of this weird allegory, and him shutting the door or Diane Lane shutting the door, like for me brought to mind, like Matt Lauer with the button and the door, you know, like all this, like, it's like men are, they're, don't worry, you know, that just, it didn't sit well with me.
The last thing I want to talk about, is this part with Ron Livingston's character where he has this interesting swing from the I knew it person to later in the episode telling this odd, like, childhood anecdote where he, like, befriended a girl who, like, he thought was a boy and all, you know, it's like this very, I just can't even describe it. It's so weird. And, which is all like a run up to him giving this really, self-righteous speech to his boys and to his wife about like how judging someone, how going with the crowd and judging someone, is the worst thing you can do in the world. And how dare you? And, you know, to say like, we can't judge David this way because that is the, you know, my father instilled in me as a child, that was the worst thing I could do. It's incredibly heavy handed. This like lecturing of the episode's message, which is then muddled by like his later reveal. He's like, yeah, that person was a girl. And then Diane Lane like gives this confused face that I shared in that moment of like, what is happening right now? What did you think of this?
I didn't like the flashbacks in general. I thought that like that didn't need to be.
I kind of liked. I mean, I will interject and say I kind of liked seeing what this guy had meant to her revealed that way. Like, because yeah. We couldn't see it within the context of her doubt.
Right.
You know, and so we had to see it in a different time. And so to see him both like telling her that she deserved a nice house, which is like whatever. But more importantly, like the relief she felt when he was able to communicate with her child in a way that like other people haven't been able to, that I thought was kind of powerful actually. Because
yeah.
that relief, that gratitude, and then like learning to lean upon that person in that role, you know, like just really underlines what a trusted part of, you know, this person's, you know, cause like not everyone in the world can relate to like, I'm sorry, what does a piano teacher mean to someone? Like, why is that like so important? And then it's like, no, this is a very trusted figure in the formation of her children's lives. So I did like that, but the flashback from the dad to his childhood was like,
yeah,
extremely baffling to me.
Yeah. It was hokey and like not him and felt like oddly weird. Sorkin-y, in a strange way. It's funny though, the piano thing, like, God, I think I texted you, like, I was having piano recital, like, horrible nightmare flashbacks. I took piano lessons for maybe 12 years as a kid, and, you know, I didn't have a very close relationship with my piano teacher, but, you know, we would go to her house, and, it is a weird relationship, you know, any sort of, I mean, it akin to a coach or whatever, but I thought he got that stuff well. And you're right that the in establishing how these people interacted with him before this thing had troubled their opinion of him is interesting. But yeah, the Ron Livingston thing, I also don't see what that would have to do with this other thing, you know, like,
yeah.
Well, I understand what it has to do in terms of maybe the episode discreetly, but like if we're bringing Weiner's stuff into it, like that feels like, why are you conflating those two things that aren't the same thing? And also in terms of what David has maybe not even been accused of, what, like, it's possible there has been a complaint made about, like, that's a very different thing. That's a different kind of believing someone. It's a different kind of not going with the crowd, you know? And I think that associating those two things is, well, what a lot of men are doing right now, frankly.
So, it sounds to me like your reaction to this episode is a lot closer to what some other people who have been more critical of the season as a whole have felt. Does this, you know, like, especially episode 3, which you liked so much, I think a lot of people found a lot of what we're seeing in this episode in that episode. Like, does this episode's tone, depiction flavor your overall reaction to the series?
It makes me a lot more skeptical of the project. Yeah. You know, I think that when you look at this, now that I'm 5+ hours in, starting to get a picture of the series in aggregate, it's like, okay, like, you know, he's exploring wealth and class and this and that. But, like, is this mostly just, like, what Matt Weiner feel like he wanted to talk about but was silenced, you know, and was given $45 million to do it? Like, because if that's the case, if we're going to keep seeing these breadcrumbs, like, back that lead back toward him, that's going to maybe, that'll negatively color my opinion of the whole thing. But I'm not selling it off yet.
I will say I have a hard time finding any of this, any of the stuff that we see in this and the stuff that we saw in episode 3, House of Special Purpose. I'm having trouble seeing that in the upcoming episodes 6 and 7, both of which I've seen. I think especially episode 7 is someone else's story. It's based on a true story that happened to someone, and it has nothing to do with any of this. And so, like, there are episodes upcoming that, like, are sort of free from any of this. But I agree. I mean, once again, I think it's very interesting to me that this episode was held back from me. If you're gonna give me most of the episodes of a season and hold one back, then, like, you know, I'm gonna look at it with a special interest. So
yeah,
here we are. That being said, I mean, I think you disagree with me, but I actually really, really liked Diane Lane's performance in this episode. It's a tough role to sell, I think, because she's such a cipher. She's not a cipher, but she's just sort of like, she's in a place of, despite all her action, she's in a place of sort of intellectual inaction. And so because of that, I think that makes her character maybe somewhat inaccessible, but I don't know. She really worked for me in this.
Yeah. I mean, I like her, and I think that for me, she felt a little miscast because I think that Diane Lane is a bit cooler than, and I mean, like, hipper than her character here, and it has a bit more edge. Like, I think when you see her, I mean, in another sort of, you know, wealthy mother role as Pat Loud in the HBO's movie about an American family, the kind of first ever reality series, you see some of that edge here. Here it's kind of gone because she's supposed to be a bit, like, not flighty exactly, but sort of just like high strung rich lady, you know, and I don't know. I don't love her in that mode, but she's good. I think it's great to see Nicole Ari Parker get something to do. Cara Buono, you know, from Mad Men is great. And Randles, I think, did a good job with a role that I think is really tricky, you know, just in premise, but also how it's written.
That seems like a great segue into our discussion with Andrew Reynolds, who had, I think, his own set of doubts and revelations in being in this episode.
I'm Claire Fallon.
And I'm Emma Gray. We're culture writers, podcasters, and hosts of the show Love to See It.
Every week, we give an unapologetically feminist dissection of reality dating shows, rom-coms, and other romance narratives. We unpack all the weird messages they send us about love, sex, and dating.
And we dive into all the details with special guests like actors, authors, and cultural critics.
You can find Love to See It wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Tuesday.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for chatting with me.
I wanted to kick off by asking you what your first initial reaction was reading the script for this episode.
Initially when I read it, I was a little, I'll be honest, I was sort of confused as to how I was supposed to feel about this character, about the character that Matt was asking me to play, which is David, the piano teacher. And I had to read it a few times to sort of unpack where I landed on that, you know, whether or not these accusations about him were true, whether we were supposed to think that they were true, was there a way for me to play this that, you know, sort of left all of that up in the air? Like, where was the line there? So it took a few reads and a very long conversation with Matt to sort of figure out if I felt like I was capable of doing it. The other big piece of it, which is just a technical piece, which is I don't play the piano.
Right.
And having to be a classical piano teacher, I've seen that sort of butchered in ways before on film. And I was like, I don't want to be some like hack guy who, you know, looks like he's in the Partridge Family playing a keyboard. Like, I can't do that. So he assured me that they would have, you know, for the close-ups, we had a really amazing, really talented classical pianist come in, and he doubled for parts of it. And then I also just had a really incredible coach that I worked with a lot here in Los Angeles to sort of figure out basically the fastest way to kind of, like, cheat my hands. Certainly not that I could play any of that, but at least I would be sort of like hovering in the right area.
To circle back to that conversation you had with Matt about ambiguity, was it his intention that this episode be entirely ambiguous in terms of David's actions? And how did you decide to play that?
Yeah, I think that obviously I had to sort of make a choice as an actor. Like, I had to sort of pick, you know, what I was playing at any given moment. So I made the decision that he hadn't done anything wrong, but he was still kind of a sketchy character, for lack of a better term. You know, I mean, he has a lot of insecurities. He has a lot to lie about. Or exaggerate, if you want to be generous. He is desperately trying to fit into this group of people that he does not feel he belongs in. But all of that said, like, I still didn't think he was really necessarily guilty of anything, but it was a lot of fun from an acting standpoint to sort of figure out who he was at any given moment with any of the people that he was dealing with.
The Ron Livingston character has this line where he, you know, when he finds out about the initial accusation about David, he says sort of, "I knew it." And then he has this other reaction about, well, you know, gay stereotypes, stereotypes about gay men and children or something like that. And this is where I'm going to let my co-host Richard Lawson speak for himself. I just want to quote his initial reaction to the episode that he sent to me, where he says, the way gay men are embraced but kept at a distance and always feared for the shit, it locates all the quiet trauma of straight guardedness around gay men, especially with children. It's so exhausting to be wary of kids and interacting with them. And I'm wondering if you had a reaction similar at all to Richard's when you were working on this episode.
Absolutely. And I think your colleague said that very well. I think that I'll be totally honest with you, a large part of my conversation with Matt was, I think that there is a often confusion. I think that there is some confusion between the difference of homosexuality and pedophilia in a lot of people's minds.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tricky thing that I don't notice it so much anymore, but I certainly, you know, as a kid heard comments about adult gay men, and there's maybe some sort of perceived danger there. I didn't think as a out actor who's also now playing a gay character, like, do we really need to try to make that any more confusing for people who might be confused, that there's any correlation between those two things. And I ultimately sort of came to the conclusion that your colleague did, which was, I think it is something that still exists, and it is an interesting conversation to be had. And those lines that Ron's character has about him, I was like, well, that's probably very realistic in a lot of parts of the country and, in the city that we were filming in. So I guess I felt like it was a conversation that was interesting and valid and hopefully potentially, particularly because of the end of the episode when Diane's character sort of, she takes the leap of faith that everything is fine, that she trusts this guy. And that was a story that, it was not ever validated and don't even know what the details of it are, and that ultimately he has given them no reason to panic or to doubt him. And she makes the choice to continue on with this guy, and she shuts the door and she, lets him stay in their lives. So I thought that the resolution of it was interesting enough that it supported the argument.
The episode has so many references to the San Francisco Bay Area. But it seems to be set in LA, and I'm wondering, what we're meant to take from the setting of this particular episode.
It was set in Los Angeles. It was written to be San Francisco, and then the fires that were taking place last January in the Bay Area sort of prevented us from filming there, unfortunately. So at the last minute, everything shifted down to LA. So we filmed the bulk of those interiors in Pasadena. In these beautiful, huge old homes. But you're right, initially it was written to be in the Bay Area, but everything sort of got shifted south, unfortunately.
Okay. And because, to go back to what you were saying before, because the episode deals so much in negative perceived stereotypes about gay men, how do you then, as an actor, calibrate your performance within an episode that are about stereotypes?
I mean, I had to sort of be as clear as possible as to who this person was at any given moment. Mm-hmm. And the sort of challenge for me was that he changes his demeanor depending on who he's in a room with. So, when he's with Ron Livingston's character, he very much tries to, sort of be a guy with him. And then when he's with Cara Buono and Nicole Ari Parker, he's very much trying to be a catty mom. And he's constantly shifting and adjusting and trying to figure out who he is. So it was a challenge to figure out underneath that, like, who is this guy? Like, who is what kind of human is he? Is he a bad person? Is he a good person? Is he just a confused person? So it was a lot to sort of, sift through and untangle in any given scene as to sort of where his head was. But, It also sort of, I get asked a lot about playing gay characters because I predominantly on television play gay characters? And isn't that limiting? And isn't that, don't you feel pigeonholed by that? And my response is always, it's only limiting if the writing is bad. And this was a perfect example of, you know, to say that someone's sexuality defines every aspect of their life is really reductive and very, it's not true. There's a lot of different types of gay people. And I thought I had never come across a character who happened to be gay, but was also this complex and a really, with his insecurity and with his need to fit in with these people and his desire to belong to this group. I had never read a gay character who was that sort of complicated and kind of unlikable. And that was intriguing to me, and also just, you know, made my point that just because a character is gay doesn't mean it's necessarily the same person.
Right.
Because that's always the assumption then. It's like, well, there's only one type of gay person, so it must be really exhausting just playing that person over and over again. and this, you know, made my point that this was a weird one. And I had the opportunity to work quite a bit last year on different projects, and all of the characters, or most of the characters, were gay, and they were all very different. And it was really, it was an exciting, exciting year as an actor to sort of go through and see that there's lots of different ways to play these people.
Well, and it's so interesting that you talk about the way, you know, David changes his persona as sort of like this code switching way in which to interact with different people.
Yeah.
Is there a moment or an interaction where you think that he is his most authentic self?
I think the only time that he really drops it is with Catherine, with Diane Lane, when he's talking about why he teaches. He's playing for her, and he's explaining that
right. You
know, he thought maybe his career would have gone someplace else as a performer, and then it did not. And that you find yourself having to make a choice at a certain point as an adult. You know, do I play on a cruise ship, or do I play at a Nordstrom, or do I start teaching? And he makes this decision to start teaching and really loves it. And I think that's the only time that he's really telling the truth, both to himself and to whoever he's with. And the fact that he chooses to share that with Catherine, I think, is no surprise then that she ultimately decides, you know, that he's a trustworthy person. And regardless of whatever these rumors are, she has no reason to doubt him. But for me, that was the only time that I think he was really being truthful.
Obviously, this episode is not coming out in a vacuum. It's coming out in a broader conversation about witch hunts and false accusations and the Me Too movement and all of that. How do you feel this episode sits in that conversation, and what are you hoping people take from it?
Well, I think if Diane's characters, you know, if she's the audience, you know, if she's representing the general viewer here, she asks a lot of questions. She does the research that she feels like she needs to do. She goes on this fact-finding mission of her own to sort of decide what she thinks is true. Whereas, you know, there are people, I think that the episode is really well crafted, but like, you know, Cara Buono's character, she just immediately decides she's out. She wants nothing to do with David anymore. She doesn't want him anywhere near the family and the house. Nicole Ari Parker's character really doubles down and defends him in a really, in a very energetic way, that she decides that it can't possibly be true, any of these stories. But Diane is the only one who asks questions, and she's the only one who tries to find out for herself. And ultimately, she has to just make a decision. And the fact that she makes a decision to, at the end of the episode, to close that door and to let the lesson continue, and I think it's an interesting and powerful statement about how we receive information and how we make up our minds for ourselves. And so I think there are questions that need to be asked, and there are conversations that need to be had before any decisions are actually made. So I think her character represents you know, a version of perhaps what we all should be doing when we hear stories, be it about, you know, I think, you know, be it about the elections, or, you know, you can't just read a headline, you have to read the whole article. And I think we're certainly in a moment right now where everybody is just reading blips of information and maybe not doing a deep dive. And there are certainly issues that you have to do a deep dive in.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate the time.
Thank you. And tell your colleague, thanks for the thoughtful questions, because that was certainly on my radar as well.
Well, that is it for our discussion of episode 5, Bright and High Circle. We will be back next week with Panorama, which and a conversation with actress Rhonda Mitchell, who I have been a huge fan of ever since Pitch Black. Richard, in the meantime, where can people find your work?
On VF.com, and they can find me curled up in a ball having flashbacks to going to piano lessons, having not practiced. Where will you be, and where can they find you?
They can find me on VanityFair.com. They can find both of us over on Little Gold Men. And then you can also find me going around lying about the fact that I've got a Romanoff Bible in my possession.
You're lying that you don't. That's the lie.
All right. I'm going to stop.
Romanoff.
I'm Olga Romanoff.
Michael Romanoff.
He said he was a Romanoff?
You know, she's a Romanoff.
Checking in for a Romanoff.
I'm Romanoff. I'm so tired of this Romanoff shit.
Nicholas Romanoff.
I could be a Romanoff.
He's a Romanoff too.
Want to stay up to date on the biggest stories in pop culture and entertainment? Then be sure to check out the TMZ podcast. I'm Charlie Cotton from TMZ, the TV show, and every day I'll sit down with a member of our news team to give exclusive breakdowns of the day's most talked about headlines, stories we break, and the stories you care about. So check out the TMZ podcast, Monday through Friday, and the other podcasts from the TMZ Audio Network, like Last Days and TMZ Verified, available on all podcast platforms.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.